Women Oral History 2, reviewing Bernard Goldberg, today's June 23rd, 1986. The interviewers are Emily Andelman and Marion Levant. I wanted to pick up some things from last session. Your sister's name, you don't have.
Oh, Edith Rose.
And what was her married name?
Young. Her name in Hebrew was Chaya Brazel.
I wanted to ask you, you had mentioned that, ironically, that it was more profitable to be on tour in the early days than to be in the city. Why was that?
Let's put it this way. The Symphony Society, or the sponsoring organizations, prevailed among most of the symphony orchestras in the country. It was not more profitable. They lost less money.
All right.
Because usually the orchestras played 5 or 6 concerts a week,
mm-hmm.
whereas in our hometowns we played usually 2 concerts a week. So there was that much difference in income. Usually the fees for each performance were guaranteed by the sponsoring organization, whereas
mm-hmm.
for example, in Pittsburgh, we had to depend upon box office, which didn't make up in former years even half of the budget.
Mm-hmm.
I think now we make up a little more than half. But there's no comparison between the budget of the Pittsburgh Symphony now and what it was years ago. In the early days, you know, it was people like Charlie Rosenblum and a few others, Edgar Kaufman, who were there
mm-hmm.
with the checkbook at the end of the season. Some others. But I tell you...
Who else was there that you can think of?
Well, there was the Dodds family, of course the Hines family, and the people from Big Steel.
Mm-hmm. Were any of them Jewish? Of the philanthropists that supported the symphony?
Oh, yes. Obviously Charlie Rosenblum. And Bill Benswanger,
mm-hmm.
who was the first writer of program notes.
Mm-hmm.
For symphony, and then Eugene Bramer, who was vice president of Copperwell Steel,
mm-hmm.
friend of Fritz Reiner, all these people, you know, who...
Hey, tell me about these wealthy people who helped support it. Were they... Did they interact with the symphony itself? Did they do anything other than attend concerts and spend money?
Oh, some people did. Some people were very friendly. Mrs. Bramer was always very cordial. And then Charlie Rosenblum's wife had been a principal harp of the symphony.
Mm-hmm.
So she interacted with the musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they all interacted with the conductor. That was a very glamorous hired hand
mm-hmm.
for them. And, you know, I was told that each corporation was told to give so much by the boss, which was the Mellon Bank. The Mellon Bank owned so much of
mm-hmm.
of Pittsburgh. And, of course, then the people would get interested. When I first arrived, there was a president of the Symphony Society, and his name slips my mind at this moment. And he was a very sturdy friend of the orchestra, but the concerts for him meant a very pleasant nap.
Yes.
I complained once during a chit-chat with ProPublica solve that, but oh, I said Pittsburgh is so provincial, some of those people, they just sleep during the concerts, the rich people who give the money. He says, just, you have to give them even more praise because they're giving money for something they don't benefit from.
Did you personally, or did you know of anyone who was discriminated against within the symphony, the hierarchy, was being Jewish? Was it a benefit? Was it a deficit? Did it matter at all?
I don't think it mattered at all as far as the membership of the orchestra itself, the playing members. After all, Otto Klemperer was Jewish, Fritz Reiner was Jewish, Paul Paré, who had nothing to do with hiring or firing, was married to a Jewish lady, and Steinberg was Jewish. I don't think it meant anything at all. But certainly, many people, no matter who they were not accepted in certain places in the city.
Mm-hmm. Such as?
Well, for example, Mrs. Bremer, who herself was not Jewish, couldn't join the Pittsburgh Athletic Association.
Mm-hmm.
And after her husband died, her brother said to her, Betsy, now that Charlie is not Charlie, what was his name? Gene is gone, unfortunately. You're at Syria Mosque for so many events, why don't you try to join? It would be just convenient for you. And she said, all right, put my name in. So she got a telephone call that she was going to be blackballed. She said, why? Well, because when that tour of Shakespeare's Othello was here some years ago, Paul Robeson was your guest.
My goodness.
She said, you mean to tell me that you're not going to accept me in your organization because of that? Yes. Well, she said, that's the greatest, about the greatest praise I've had in years. Thank you. Goodbye. And she was also instrumental in getting black people into the Playhouse. Very strong lady, a strong fighter.
When you say black people into the Playhouse, you mean as actors, as guests?
As guests and as participating artists.
What about blacks as musicians?
Well, you know, we have two black people in the Pittsburgh Symphony, both of whom are Pittsburghers. And they were engaged because they're good players. I haven't, in the many years of sitting on audition committees, I've very seldom seen many black players. We've had more than just the two local kids.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very pleased to say that they made their early beginnings in orchestral playing in the Pittsburgh Youth Symphony. In fact, one night we were playing a concert in heaven knows where, in some mill town, and Paul Ross, a black violin player, was sitting in front of me. And I said, hey, Paul, you're getting too fat. And Aaron Chaffetz, who a violist, who was a friend of mine all the way back in student days in Juilliard, turned around and said to me, you can't talk to Paul that way. I said, sure I can. I love Paul. He started the back of the second violin section in the youth orchestra and became concertmaster, and now he's with us. I said, why, Paul's like my oldest son. And Aaron looked at me, and he looked at Paul and said, he doesn't look Jewish. So quick like that. Aaron was personnel manager, and he's since retired. This is his first year out of the orchestra. Brilliant guy.
Tell me about the Youth Symphony.
Well, there was a youth orchestra, I guess before I came to Pittsburgh, which was conducted by Stanley Levin.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know for what reason it came to an end. I have no knowledge of that whatsoever. But when Carl Kritz became the associate conductor of the Pittsburgh Symphony, he and Mrs. Mazel decided to start a youth orchestra. And within 3 weeks, I volunteered to coach individual sessions.
What year was this?
I should know because the orchestra's just observed a big anniversary. But it slips my mind. 35 years ago? No, it can't be 35. 30 years ago. I guess 30 years ago.
Okay, that would be 56.
Yes.
About then. Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. A couple years after Steinberg came. It was the first year that Steinberg came, Bakalennikov was still here but ailing, and the next year he passed away. So Kritz came in. So, little by little I was given more responsibilities, and then as the orchestra grew I became assistant and then associate conductor until recent years, when with the Steinberg Fellow program of sort of advanced student conductor, if you want to call it that, or a young professional conductor, was given a grant from some kind of foundation. Who put up that money? Obviously not Steinberg, but in memory of Steinberg. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I don't know. Which gives the young person a month with the Pittsburgh Symphony, observing the conductors, whoever happens to be here, and doing some work with the orchestra, doing kiddie concerts or whatever, and then conducting the youth orchestra while Mr. Lancaster has his month in England, now in Hartford, Connecticut. So there was not really much need for me anymore, and just had a parting of the ways.
It was Mrs. Mazel who founded
yes.
the current orchestra?
Mm-hmm. And the thing is that I had played with Lauren Mazel when I was a student in Interlaken, I was in high school, and Lauren came at the age of 9 with his teacher, Vladimir Bakalennikov. And I remember that when Bakalennikov was conducting, who was associate conductor of the Pittsburgh Symphony, when Bakalennikov was conducting, he insisted on certain standards of performance and said there's no reason that young people shouldn't play well. Just have to concentrate and work until you get there. So when the youth orchestra was started, that inspired me to want to offer whatever I could to help the young people grow. And of course the youth orchestra has an list of alumni in various positions throughout the world. It's mm-hmm. amazing. So there are many, it was a great deal of fun, and 2 trips to Europe with them, sometimes difficult things after when you're traveling with young people. Different backgrounds. And Mrs. Mazel has just retired.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about Lauren.
Well, I have to say, without appearing to insult the man, that at least the baton technique, he was almost as good at the age of 9 as he is now. And he conducted by memory.
At nine.
Mark Slav on one program, and Mendelssohn Italian Symphony, and Symphony No. 4 on another program, and then a little piece by an 11-year-old girl by the name of Dika Nulin. And I know that he came, I have to say that with a certain amount of bragging, he came to find me in the dining hall and told me that he thought that I understood the flute solo in the speak a Newland piece so well. And his mother said, behave yourself. This chubby little boy, just chubby cheeks. Where did I put that? I put the program with his picture in it someplace.
And did you remain friendly with him over the years? Or?
Well, yes, when I came to the Pittsburgh Symphony, he was still in college. A lady had, Agnes Dodds had managed to sponsor a string quartet for him to play in. We gave concerts at the Old Y, I think I mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the pleasure of playing with him a couple times. And when he joined the Pittsburgh Symphony, of course, I learned him. He was always a little bit to himself because his mind was growing all the time. You know, he was learning. It was very funny. On the same stand of first violins, Lauren, myself, and Werner Tarkanovsky. And Werner became the conductor of the New Orleans Symphony, and I don't know what he's doing. Just resigned from Carnegie Mellon. And they would sit and look at, there was a period of guest conductors before Steinberg, and they would sit and look at some of the people with such disapprobation, you know, as if to say, are you kidding?
Well, his conducting has, he was apparently quite a brilliant conductor at 9.
Yes, he really was.
How about now? I mean, how do you feel he is as a conductor now, his place in the musical world?
Oh, he's really incredible. I think certainly, when Steinberg was at his height and in the best days of Fritz Reiner, we played very well. But with Lauren, of course, it's a much better orchestra now. The younger players are better, and the orchestra can afford to attract better players. With Lauren, we achieve a degree of brilliance and ensemble that is really so exciting. It just dazzles the audience.
What is it about him that you think brings this on?
First of all, he's a good conductor. He knows how. He's played in orchestra, he's been conducting all his life, and he handles the stick in such a way that he communicates to us and he conducts us. He doesn't conduct for the audience. You know, he doesn't make the kind of unnecessary gestures of which might look marvelous. Some people think they're doing that, but they're not, because they've never played in an orchestra. They don't know what the people sitting making the noises need in order to play together.
Mm-hmm.
Lauren does. And with his incredible memory, he can concentrate on communicating to the musicians, whereas people who have to be constantly referring to the score are looking at the notes instead of at the musicians, so it's not at all the same.
When you talk about baton technique, what specifically do you mean?
Ah. Well, first of all, there are certain patterns which are recognized the world over for various time signatures, you know, whether they're 2 beats to the measure, 5, or whatever. And some conductors can't even do that well, or they become so sophisticated and arrogant that they dispense with that, yeah, and just give funny things and we don't know what they have in mind. But far beyond that, it's the communication of mood, of pulse, of phrase, loudness, softness, kind of attack. Everything can be conveyed by the hands and the face. So a poor baton technique can ruin an orchestra. People complain to me about certain problems with Pittsburgh Symphony. When are we going to get a conductor who's going to do something about that? When we get a conductor who knows how to conduct, it's taken care of in 5 minutes, because we have, after all, fine musicians here.
Mm-hmm.
And Lauren has that. I'm not giving an advertisement for Lauren Mazel, but it's an interesting existential experience for me, you know,
mm-hmm.
that I at the age of 16, Lauren at the age of 9, and we find ourselves now in our middle, I mean, more than middle years, still working together. Of course, he's had such a brilliant career in Europe. In Europe, he's a superstar, much more so than in the United States.
Do you feel that he will eventually become the conductor here?
I have no idea. I don't know, I know less about it than the people who read the Pittsburgh papers regularly.
How many years were you at Interlaken?
I was there as a high school student in for one summer, and then I went back for part of a season after my first year at Juilliard. My brother was head librarian. Then the summer after I graduated Juilliard, my brother was drafted, and so I took his place as librarian, completely unprepared. I left the library in such a mess. But
tell me about the place.
Well, it was started by a visionary by the name of Joseph Maddy and a friend, Thaddeus P. Giddings, both music educators. Mr. Maddy had been a violinist, a violist with the Minneapolis Symphony in the early days. And they conceived the notion it would be nice to have a place where young musicians could go away from home and up in the North Woods to rehearse and play concerts with the kind of leadership and to have the kind of lessons that they couldn't get otherwise. Very knowledgeable, after all, about the situation in the small towns, particularly in the Middle West. So they tried and it got going, and now it's just monstrous. Enormous. At the time when I was there, the entire enrollment was smaller than the present day faculty.
Were there other youth symphonic orchestras or that type of thing that you were involved with as a teenager?
Well, there was the so-called Scholarship Symphony Orchestra in St. Louis, which was, I guess, one of the early youth orchestras. The principal French horn of the St. Louis Symphony had ambitions to be a conductor, so he put together these musicians to practice conducting. At the same time, it gave the rest of the, gave us an opportunity to play, which was a lot different from the high school band that I had in Belleville, Illinois.
Can you tell us a little about Bakalynikov?
Bakalynikov?
Bakalynikov.
As he used to say, the farmer in the dell, the farmer in the dell, Vladimir Bakalynikov, the farmer in the dell. Bakalynikov was a very wonderful viola player who had played in the quartet of the Archduke something or other in St. Petersburg before the revolution. Came to this country with, I don't know exactly the details of the history. His two brothers went to Hollywood, and Baki eventually became the first violist and associate conductor of the Cincinnati Symphony. And then when Fritz Reiner left Cincinnati to come to Pittsburgh, he came along. A very fine artist. Evidently a good teacher. I had my first classes in conducting with him at Interlaken.
Hmm.
He was just remarkable in his way of communicating to audiences. If only the youngsters in the schools could have understood what he claimed to be English, they would have learned a great deal from him. And always a very fine string player and a conductor who could produce string sound equaled by few. I certainly had my disagreements with him, but he was a very fine person and Lauren's teacher, among others.
Conducting teacher?
Yes. No, Lauren studied violin with Ralph Lawando, who became a voice teacher, and he learned all the routines from his wife. And who's still teaching, so far as I know. He rented a studio in Carnegie Hall in New York and still teaches. He must be close to 100.
You had told us last time that you considered yourself a link in the chain of the humanist tradition.
I hope so.
Could you talk a little bit about the humanist tradition and what you see that as?
Well, after all, music, the creation performance of music necessitates technique, either in composition or in performance. It really necessitates a great deal of technique in listening, but we don't, unless you want to become a creator or performer of music, we usually don't really work at it. We read stories about music, which are not necessary. But the ear training, but the notion that music means something is, I think, at the core of what I call a humanist tradition, the emphasis or the belief that music is not necessarily an experience, a language unto itself. It is, in its own way, just as language is a language unto itself. Stravinsky said that music has no meaning, that it's just the play of time, of sound in time, organized sound in organized time, or organized into time. And that the human mind has a capability of thinking this way and enjoying it just in itself. And I think that a great deal of his music exemplifies that point of view. But certainly in music history, we say that from Beethoven on, music was meant to have meaning. Well, I think that it must have happened long before that. I would suspect that as soon as the primitive man discovered that they could make different sounds in different spaces of time, they began to try to communicate at least the religious feelings or whatever.
I think we have about 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay. So I think that music, like art, like the plastic arts, communicates emotions, perhaps not specifically. One can't, as Richard Strauss claimed, be able to tell from a certain phrase that the lady had red hair. But in general, and I think that particularly in recent years, post World War II, until more recent years, because now we have what's called a neo-romanticism, but anyway, that the emphasis was on compositional technique and performance technique. In other words, the musicians were only playing for ourselves, creating and playing for ourselves, which many non-musicians enjoyed. But as somebody said to me, you know, I used to go to the Pittsburgh Symphony Concerts when I was a law student at Pitt, and when Steinberg would do Bruckner or Brahms, Mahler, that it changed my life. And that's what I think music is about. I told you my mother's reaction to the Mozart concerto.
Yeah.
And that exemplifies to me what the musician should be trying to do. We can't put meanings into music. If it's not there, it's not there. But just to play Mozart faster or slower, louder or softer, is not quite enough. I think we have to, as Casals said,